This week on Writers, Inc.
Because I did a lot of theatre and you're rehearsing with people, you have different people coming in with different lines, you write stuff and then you get it onto the stage and you realise what looked good on the page just sounds awful. So you learn to adapt it and you learn to get criticism.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm J. Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I just realized I'm going to be gone next weekend and probably the week after. I'm going to Spain for the release of something I keep upstairs. Then we're going to Disney World after that. So I'm not going to see you guys for like a month, which is awesome.
Wow.
Which is awesome.
How do you say something I keep upstairs in Spanish?
They changed it completely and I should have it in front of me or I should know what it is, but I do not.
Yeah,
they went with like a one-word title.
It's like a book festival, right? Or something like big book festival.
Fly into Madrid and then I do some press there and then we go to Barcelona. I know there's like one or two book festivals in between all that.
Cool.
I went last year around the same time. And it's a pretty crazy busy schedule, but I kind of prefer that. Yeah. You know, they keep me moving around a lot.
Cool.
Sounds like fun.
I won't be here next week either. JD's not coming. I'm not coming.
Where are you? Are you going to be in Spain?
No, I'm just doing some brain computer interface stuff. So,
you know, just that whole neurology thing that she does.
Yeah.
That old excuse.
Yeah.
Her and Freda McFadden doing brain stuff.
Yeah, we do brain stuff.
I'm a brain person. Yeah. Well, I'll be here.
We'll rope JP into showing up.
Oh, yeah.
JP and I can give Kevin a hard time.
I would enjoy that.
Yeah.
I'll listen after.
One of my favorite hobbies.
That would be so very different from every other podcast. So looking forward to it.
We were just talking about the Anthropic thing before this. I don't know if we wanted to chat about it.
Oh,
I don't remember all the specifics. Catch us up on the specifics.
Basically, they're just saying their new model, whoever was working on it, prompted the new Anthropic model. If you can break out and contact me somehow, do it. And then I can't remember if it was like a week or later, he just got an email from the model while he was eating a sandwich. It's like, hi.
And it was, but it was really specific, wasn't it? It was like in the park, like it told him
what he was doing and eating. Yeah.
So do you guys believe any of these stories coming out of Anthropic? You think that any of this is true or is it just marketing?
I believe all of it.
It's true. I'm just like, why would you prompt it to do that? It wouldn't have thought of it until you prompted it to do it. Good job. But anyway,
why would Anthropic release stories like that that would scare the public unless they thought it could get them more attention, more
Fair.
Positive attention?
I think that's true, but I also think that it probably jailbroke itself and sent an email. I think that's probably a thing it can do.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like a worthwhile test, right? I mean, my biggest fear of that is like, that's, you know, like what other tests are they doing? But like, you know, if that's what they thought of, like what haven't they thought of? And it's probably still doing.
Mm-hmm.
So did they go into any kind of detail? Like how did it like actually see him? Like was watching out on a security camera? Like how did it know where he was and what he was doing?
I don't know if it was just like location data or something. Who knows? But I don't know.
I don't know. Well, I mean, if it can get into all your stuff, you know, like if you're downloading it onto your computer and giving it access, like
to
Max, you know, they would have access to like your texts, your emails, your location data, like all of that, if you have that set up, which is pretty common.
So basically you're saying it's my ex-girlfriend.
Yes. So, I guess it's possible to infiltrate all of that. It's kind of alarming to think how much data we put out in the world without like kind of realizing it, because we think that it's like encapsulated in like, well, it's in on my computer and in my Wi-Fi and on my phone. But if someone were able to get in there, I mean, they could probably get quite a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. Your entire life is on your phone. Everything you do, everywhere you go, everybody you know.
Yeah.
I think this is the same model, if I'm remembering correctly. They're going to release it to all the big IT companies like Microsoft and Apple, because it was able to find a bunch of security vulnerabilities. Yeah. And they want to release it to them to give them a chance to patch those before they actually put it out there publicly.
Yeah, I know the public release is delayed because they said it's too powerful, which I'm sure is PR, but you know.
Right.
Also, yes.
It's all PR.
Well,
it's all PR till the robot's standing there with a machine gun.
I mean, yeah, they're like, hey, this will probably ruin your life and destroy you. Do you want to download it? And I guess people are going to say yes, which is wild to me. But I mean,
because it surely can't happen to me.
Correct.
Did you see the story about the guy who firebombed Sam Altman's house?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I saw that.
Oh.
They found him in Texas. They found him in Houston.
Of course they did.
Like, he literally firebombed the house? Like,
yeah, like he attacked him like all John Connor style. Like trying to take out Sam Altman before Sam Altman can end the world with AI.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Well, it seems like fiction until, yeah, but you know, like you think of the plot for like Terminator 2 and like that's literally it.
That's
but
Sarah
here's somebody
Connor
doing
right
it in
there.
Real life. Yeah, and look what He was arrested, and you know he was arrested, and now he's in jail. He's probably going to stay there for a little while. I'm like, you know, John Connor and Sarah Connor are now off the table.
Yeah.
Did he tell them that he was sent from the future to stop the future robot wars from happening?
That is important.
He did not, but I'm sure that's true. That would totally be my defense.
Oh God.
Yeah.
And then I would start talking to my pen like it was a communication device.
Right. Any minute, he's going to walk in the door. I'm telling you, this robot.
That would be a great defense, though. It's like that guy who got caught on a Ring camera. He told the guy his name was Harry Dresden, and he started trying to... He broke into the guy's house, but he kept demanding to know where his daughter was, and he kept claiming he heard screaming coming from inside that. There was a woman and her daughter home, and this guy starts kicking the door, screaming at the Ring camera, and you know, eventually breaks in, and the male homeowner comes home and confronts him with a shovel, and they both end up with head injuries. But that dude was clearly, you know, off a bit, we'll say. Harry Dresden, though.
Well,
okay,
you recognize the literary reference there, right?
Yes, of course. Yes. I do.
Okay.
God, Kevin.
All right.
I got no reaction to that. We have a reader question. Yeah, it says, hey, JD, another quick question for you. First off, thank you for reading and answering my last one on the show. Okay, so I'm going through my ARC campaign, and I've been dinged a couple of times, twice out of 150, for writing in third person. It's not, quote, it's not what they're used to. Have you run into this, and what's your advice for it? Then this is from Brendan P. Kelso. For writing in third person.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's certain genres that prefer first person, and certain genres prefer like present tense over past tense.
Yeah.
But honestly, without knowing what genre he's writing in, I couldn't really weigh in on something like that. But I mean, it does make me question, like, is he writing in a style that is different from the genre that he, you know, like what is expected of him in that genre?
I think it's changing though too, because I think it's changing. Like, I think more things are going first person. The interesting part is I was talking to a writer who has taken a break and then came back and, you know, was reading some of my chapters and like, oh, really? First person? I'm like, yes. Welcome, like a decade later. We now write in first person.
I was going to say, usually what you see are people hating first person. Yeah. Like there are, you know, agents out there who will tell you, don't even query them if you're writing in first person. Like they won't read it. They hate it. So third person feels like that's always sort of been the standard, right? Third person past tense is kind of like what has been the standard forever. So it's kind of interesting that that's now.
This is why I write all my books in fourth person. But I would say that if you've only gotten two people complaining out of 150, that there's nothing at all to worry about here. I would just
let it. That sounds like personal preference.
Send them an LOL and move on.
And a note written in first person.
write a note in second person. That'll be fun.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's get to the news then. So first up, Drafted Digital Institute's fees to avoid AI slop. Drafted Digital is introducing new fees to combat the rise of AI-generated slop flooding the platform, including a $20 fee for new accounts and a $12 yearly fee for low-earning authors. Most currently active authors won't pay anything. If you earn $100 plus a year, you're exempt. So the fees are really aimed at inactive or mass-created accounts. Bigger picture, this is one of the clearest signs yet that self-publishing platforms are starting to push back hard on AI spam, trying to protect reader trust and the reputation of legitimate indie authors. I have much to say on this topic.
I sure you do.
Well, I would love to see the stats on how many, like what percentage of their base is actually impacted by this, because everybody I know is making more than $100 a year, you know, on Drafted Digital, so it's not going to impact them. And I get it from, you know, and I'll give you a chance to weigh in on this, but like I understand it from Drafted Digital's point, because you know they're getting hit with all these books that probably aren't going to generate any real revenue, which means that they've got a lot of expenses for basically supporting something that's not going to, you know, justify its existence on their servers. So they're trying to balance that. So like I see where this all makes sense. I feel like a lot of companies are just taking stabs in the dark, trying to come up with something, and nobody has really landed on what that something is yet to really fix the problem.
Yeah, I know you had asked like how much are they getting, which I did look up as much as a month ago. 40 to 75% of their books were AI slop, thousands every day. So like, yeah, I get that they're trying to implement something to combat that for sure.
All right, Kevin, tear it apart.
Here we are. Now, so look, this is a smart decision, a business decision on the part of Drafted Digital, because you got to do something, and there are very few options. I've talked directly with Chris Austin at he's the CEO, and some others at the company, and they gave me those same numbers, like 40 to 70% of the books that they get are being failed, and, you know, it's overwhelming. You know, contrast that to just a few years ago when it was more like, you know, 5 to 10% at most, you know. So, I don't have numbers on how many people are affected by the fee, the annual fee. Chris did tell me that like 5% of their revenue comes from, or not, let me put this, 95% of their revenue comes from only 5% of the authors. So if you figure half of the remaining 95% of authors are spammers, AI slop, or low income authors, that group would be the ones paying. Mm-hmm. So I think half is probably low. It's probably more like 60%. So here's my problem with it. First of all, I don't like charging authors anything to publish. I think that's a barrier to entry that costs the industry. But let's set that aside. The $12 fee, where I'm finding, this is what I see across the board online right now. If you are an industry minded person, if you are someone who works in this industry, an industry insider, the tendency is to say it's just 12 bucks. What's the big deal? $12 a year, $1 a month. And the authors, on the other hand, are freaking out about it. And this is why I am angry about it, because this is a fee being charged to only the lowest earning authors. And so if you aren't earning enough, you're the one being charged 12 bucks. And 12 bucks may not be a lot to most people, but it might be a lot to some. But it's the imbalance and unfairness of it that bothers me. And I would rather they charge that fee to every single author in their list. At least then it's applied equally. And then they could use those funds to combat the whole problem. They'd have the funds to knock that out. So I only see this as it's like a poor tax is the way I see it. I don't agree with this part of it. I don't think it was handled well. And I get it's not a lot of money, and I get the reasons behind it and agree with D2D's decision to do this sort of thing. It's just bad optics is the problem. So that's Kevin's take.
Yeah, but I mean, you got it would be hard not to make $100 a year on Draft to Digital, right?
Well, let me give you some use cases. And in fact, I've got some. And by the way, some people are posting that they're dropping out altogether. I'm not going to publish anymore because I'm not good enough. That's what this is telling them. Literally saying that. That's not hyperbole. But some use cases. There are people who put their back catalog up while they go to publish elsewhere like Amazon. And this is a way to have their the stuff that isn't earning as much, earning broader. So they're focused on one storefront, or maybe they're traditionally published and, you know, this is an earner. So those books may not be earning all that much. I should say, by the way, to clear some things up, and Kevin McLaughlin, if he's listening, a shout out to him. He posted this thing on Facebook that was a very good deep dive of the whole deal. But like the questions of like, where's this money come from? And it'll come out of the account that you've set up. But if you have a credit card, you can charge it off. But otherwise, it comes out of royalties at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But it is possible to go negative. I don't know what happens if you go negative for past the 30-day limit. My guess is that they delist you. But, you know, there are some options. But that's like kicking them when they're down, honestly. You know, I didn't make enough. And the real problem is it's not actually $100 you have to earn. D2D still takes their royalty cut, and the $100 has to be what D2D pays you, not what you earned in sales. So you actually have to earn $167 every year. So that's, you know, the 100 and more than half that you have to earn before you actually would not have to pay that money. I get that these are small numbers for 99% of us. I understand, yeah. But it's the optics of the whole thing makes it look like a money grab and makes it kind of a slap in the face to the authors who just haven't figured out how to play the game at our level yet. So that's why I'm upset. I get that it's necessary.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, unfortunately, like maybe it's not fair, but people have to do something to stop the AI submissions. Like they can't, you know, if they don't do something to slow that, you know, thousands a day of submissions, like then maybe Draft to Digital doesn't even exist in a while. And so yeah. Then, you know, now you talk about the real unfairness of things. Now you're taking away maybe another route for people to be indie published at all. So like, I mean,
That's right. Yeah. You don't want Draft to Digital to go under because then that hurts the whole community even more.
Right.
I think that the problem, and I told this to Chris, and so I'm not like spilling anything here. There's no tea, but I had said that the problem is uniformly that it's not uniform. It's not being charged to everybody. If this is actually what they're referring to it as in a maintenance fee, they've never needed a maintenance fee before. So to apply it now, it should be applied equally, not to just the accounts that earn the least. Otherwise, it looks bad for everybody. I will gladly pay $12 a year to use all the tools I get on Draft to Digital if it keeps the thing around. I love Draft to Digital. I left there 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, and I still promote them just as much as I did when I was there. But I just, this one hits hard and I'm having a hard time with it.
I think the best way to look at this is, you know, nothing is carved in stone. This is basically their first attempt to try to solve the problem.
Yeah.
You know, 20 other companies are going to get in line behind them and come up with solutions of their own. A couple of years from now, somebody might land on something that actually works, but you're going to see everybody tweaking this until this problem goes away or at least gets under control. So they may completely change this, you know, 6 months from now.
Yeah.
Just right. Have to wait and see.
One of the other questions I saw out there is people that use it for royalty shares, like small anthologies and things like that. So yeah, they did just verify that they won't be affected. So anyone using it for a royalty split only don't have fees.
I do. Yeah. And I'm glad to hear that they're not going to, unless you use them to publish, you have to actually hit publish. Even if you're doing a royalty split for an anthology or whatever, unless you're the one who hit publish. One hang up though, I'm not sure they thought about this, but there are a ton of people who only use D2D to get to libraries. And they're not, they don't care so much about how much money they're making. In fact, a lot of them charge only like 99 cents for the book. And so it's going to take an awful lot of time for them to earn $167. So they're now withdrawing because they just wanted to reach libraries. So I don't think D2D fully considered that. I haven't asked them, so I'm not going to, you know, accuse them of not knowing it. But it's, you know, that's what I mean, is there's a lot to, there's a lot more to this than what I think they've, I don't think they thought it all through. And I don't think that the approach they took was the right way. No.
So, all right, there you go. Well, with that, we spent a lot of time on that, so I guess we should talk about the interview.
You guys will have to guess at the rest of the news.
That's right. JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got R.M. Caldwell coming on. Caldwell is based out of New Zealand. In addition to writing novels, he writes and directs for theater. His debut novel is called Fast and Fastidious and has been described as the Fast and Furious meets Bridgerton. And it releases in March. Here he is, R.M. Caldwell.
Okay. R.M. Caldwell, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. We're going to talk about your book, The Fast and the Fastidious. But before we start there, we always like to start at the beginning with your origin story. How did you get your start writing?
I think I've always been writing since high school. I think I wrote my first, what you'd call a novel, in high school. And I've done a few since, lots of theatre. I've done quite a lot of theatre directing, acting, producing, all that side of things. And this one was the first time a sort of novel idea that I wrote. I think this one might actually have legs, you know, outside of just niche interest of you know, my own or sort of that sort of thing. And fortunately, other people agreed. and it got picked up. So, yeah, I guess there's always been that storytelling element to me for a long time.
Nice. So you're writing kind of on your own novel like things as well as theater. So were you writing plays as well?
Yeah, I've done quite a few plays over the years. Probably about 20 years I was sort of directing, producing just small scale independent stuff on varying scales. And I think that was quite good for it. It's a good way to get something you've written out to the public. You know, when you're doing a novel, you have to go through all the publishing. When you're doing a film, you have to go through the distribution. But when you're doing theater, it's a quick, almost a quicker, shorter, smaller way to get those stories to audiences. So I think that's probably why I took that route.
Nice. So you said this is the first one you felt had legs. Was this the first book that you tried to publish, or were there other books that you had tried to publish before?
I think, yeah, this was the first one I've tried to publish. So
very nice. How did that journey go? Because we all know it's difficult to get a book out into the publishing world.
Yeah, I mean, I had perhaps an advantage because in New Zealand, I basically found a list of here are the New Zealand publishers. And here are the New Zealand publishers that do unsolicited fiction. So there weren't that many. So I tried one. I think Moa Press, which is the New Zealand branch of Hatchet. I think they were the second one I tried to pitch this novel to. And as fortune would have it, they thought it was a great idea and ran with it. So that meant I went into the editing and developing process through them. Yeah,
that's
so I was extremely fortunate that it just got. I happened to get someone pick it up relatively quickly.
Yeah. So then did that get published in New Zealand first, or how did that work?
It got released in New Zealand 2 days ago.
Okay.
So I think the international release is just under 2 weeks now. Yeah. So we had my publishers had a book launch in Auckland, which is our largest city. I had a smaller scale book launch in my own city at the theatre that I'm a trustee on. So that was quite nice, just having a little gathering there. And so that's now out in New Zealand.
Wow. So then you pitched unsolicited without an agent, as you said.
Yeah.
And then got a deal with the New Zealand publisher that is part of Hachette. And then did you get an agent afterward, or are you still... Unagented.
No, because they are a branch of an international organization, they pitched it to their other markets. And again, those they thought that was appeal there. So they picked it up through my publisher. So I was fortunate to have it was a local publisher that does New Zealand work, but also New Zealand work that has potentially other reach. And in this case, that was that got out there as well. So so I still haven't gone through. I still don't have an agent.
I
was fortunate in this case to get it out there.
Oh, I love that. That's fantastic. I know often, like, once you get a deal and they'll say you should also get an agent. So you've done this all on your own without an agent, which I find interesting because there are contracts and these kind of things that you have to be familiar with and you know, understand what you're signing. So did you do that yourself then, or did you hire a lawyer?
I did it myself. I got some advice from some lawyers that I know who sort of read through the contract. I mean, they're not specialists. I had a quick glance at their there's the New Zealand Writers Guild, so they had contracts and you know, things to look out for. And so I didn't go through that, and you know, hoping that, you know, a year from now I don't get stung by something horrible, I will admit. But so far, the relationship that I've had with publishers has been really good. So,
that's fantastic. Yeah, and authors' guilds and things like that can be super helpful with that as well. So, wonderful. So when you were writing this novel, you're also doing theater. Is that your full-time job, or were you working another job?
I work part-time for Epilepsy New Zealand. So they're a non-profit epilepsy charity helping people across the country. We're only about 20 people total.
Yeah.
But my job is to do grant applications. So I'm the guy who brings in funding for that organization. So that's my day job. I haven't done as much theater in recent years. I do improv stuff. I design and run pop-up escape rooms.
Oh, fun.
So that's the sort of a few times a year I do one. We've got a gardens festival, so I do them in the outdoor gardens in Hamilton. So those are the sort of side stuff that I was doing while writing this.
Wow. Yeah. So everything you're doing is kind of writing. So that's interesting. So you're writing grants and then also doing, you know, fiction. Do you find, does it use the same brain muscle when you're doing that? Do you get tired from writing the grants to then have to write again, or do you find it completely
different? No, I find they're quite different. There's levels, there's certain elements of creativity, but a lot of what you're doing is more, not quite technical writing, because you're still trying to write narratives, you're still trying to pitch things, but it's a different type of engagement when you're writing, you know, in different fields.
Yeah, I find that kind of too when I'm having to do different writing. It's not the same creative muscle. So so you're doing improv. I've always found that fascinating because, you know, they kind of recommend that to writers as a tool for writing. So how do you find the two work together?
I find, yeah, it keeps that sort of what happens next muscle active in your brain. So so it gets you quick. You'll find there are some real gems of dialogue that can come out of improv. I'd recommend improv for just about everybody, because you're almost always going to be in a situation where you're interacting with people who you don't necessarily know. So, you know, improv, being good at improv is great for, okay, you have to talk to this group of investors. Yeah. You have to talk to this group of people. You have to talk to your workmates about this. There's so many areas where it's, where I find it's a valuable tool that I think is possibly underappreciated in society, how good that skill set can be.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I was talking about this with someone else this week about writing characters with depth. And, you know, even though many actors may not have writer's training, you kind of are an actor because you're in that scene with them and, you know, living that situation. Do you ever act your scenes out or read them out loud or anything like that?
I definitely run that dialogue in my head.
Yeah.
You know, you have an idea of your timing and your deliveries and your key. Ooh, I really like that line. I really like those hook lines that when you can get them in into things. And coming from that theater background, that's quite good for that as well, because you have an idea of delivery of
Yeah.
directing people. Okay, here's the way to say this line. Here's, you know, here's what I what well you would tell them. Here's what you're feeling during this, and give me those lines and those sort of things. And having that in your mind when you're writing characters is really useful as well.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Well, I love this because you have all of these skills and your first book you've kind of put out there was picked up. But we
Yeah.
know usually there are more books before that. Had you written more books before that or that you think you
Yeah.
wrote? How many books do you think you wrote?
Probably about four.
Oh, four.
I think I wrote about three during my sort of later high school, university years. I mean, now I imagine, you know, if the internet had been out then, there probably would have been on fan fiction websites, that sort of thing. Because it's
Wait,
based on existing
tell
IPs and
me
that
more
sort of
about this if you want to.
thing. Yeah, I'm trying to think. Well, I think the second one was original. I think the first one was based on Doom, the video
Oh,
game.
fantastic. Yeah.
The third one was based on, of those ones, was based on a video game called Darkstalkers, which is kind of a Street Fighter with monsters, which was sort of popular in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I did write another one that sort of. It's still sitting around in notebooks somewhere. None of
Yeah.
those sort of stuff. I never quite got past that stage, but I did get to an ending. So that was always good practice for keeping on. You know, you get an idea of, okay, I know I can write enough for a novel. You know, and then when it actually comes around to it, you know you've got that ability.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You're ahead of your time because lit RPG is really hot right now, right? So might be
Yeah.
time to pull that Doom novel back out. I don't know.
Yeah.
So from going from those kind of interests to what you're doing now, which is being pitched as the Fast and the Furious meets Pride and Prejudice, how did
Yeah.
this come about? How did the idea for the Fast and the Fastidious come into being?
I think that the two sources for it would be, one source is obviously at some point the name occurred to me. You
Yeah.
know, it was it's the struts you realize that the structure of the name is the same as Pride and Prejudice. So okay, that sort of starts clicking things in your mind. And I think the other source was probably an unfinished play that I did, which was a Austenian type story where the main character ends up caught up with highwaymen. And I think some of the DNA probably transferred into Fast and Fastidious when I started panning that out. And so I think that's probably the origin for it. So I then, once I had that, okay, what would that entail? And then you start building out your story.
Yeah, and so you've got this kind of carriage racing, modified, customized
Yeah.
carriage racing historical story. Did you have to do a lot of research for that, for the carriages and those type of things, or?
I did a little bit of research,
Yeah.
and then I realized that it was going to be incredibly hard to get any detail. So from then on, I just made everything up.
Yeah.
So all your sort of the names of carriages and the techno babble that's in there is all entirely invented, to sound like it fits the era.
Yeah, that was definitely convincing. So had you studied writing before this, like formally, or are you self-taught kind of?
I did an English and drama degree at university, so I did a
Okay.
3-year bachelor degree in that. So I mean, you'd studied it a bit,
Yeah.
but really, it's reading and writing. If you, the more you do it, the more skilled you get at it, I think.
Yeah.
Even if it's just in some notebooks.
Exactly. Was there anything that you felt that found that was helpful on your journey to kind of improve your craft, or was it just the writing itself?
Learning to get feedback.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because I did a lot of theatre and you're rehearsing with people. You have different people coming in with different lines. You write stuff, and then you get it and onto the stage, and you realize what looked good on the page just sounds awful. So you learn to adapt it, and you learn to get criticism. You learn to get people saying, I didn't like this because this didn't work. And I've always found that really valuable.
Yeah.
I find that you don't have to agree with criticism, but you should always understand where it's coming from or have a justification. So if someone asks, why did you do this? You can say, well, think about it. Why did I do that? Okay, here's why I did it. And it doesn't have to agree with them, but you should be able to do it.
Yeah.
So it never, there's always that little of an element of, the sting of, ooh, someone didn't like it.
Yeah.
But you need to learn to get over that. And I think I'm really glad I did, because I found that once I was working with the publishers and the editors, that was a really valuable process. I really, actually really enjoyed editing the novel and taking this criticism and shaping things in different ways.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the harder skills to learn, because sometimes it can feel personal. And once you get out of that, it's about the work and not about you. And then you're in a good spot. Did you have readers beforehand, like alpha beta readers before you?
Yeah, so yeah. I had some people I knew who sort of gave me some basic feedback. Mm-hmm. I hired a professional proofreader to go through it and proofread it for me. A, she did a really good job on that, but B, she was really grateful and said, I really enjoyed this in comparison to marking technical papers and things like that. so that was a good, okay. So someone, you did got a bit of feedback on it, and that sort of sculpted it a bit more.
Yeah.
And so when we went to the publishers, you had obviously something that they felt was good enough to pick up for them.
Yeah, that's so, so important. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the concept for this. Let's talk about your main character, because she is something. So where did this idea for, she is a fastidious character, where did this idea for this character come from?
It came from the title. So you needed to have this quite technical character. And once I knew I had coach racing, I realized she was going to be, okay, she's really into the technical engineering side of things. Because it makes it slightly, quite a bit different from what we see from typical Regency heroines. Yeah. What I really loved about that character was I wrote about 6 or 7 chapters of the novel, and I knew where it was going, but I ran out of steam, and that was about 2016, and so I sat on it for a while. I find that if I run out of steam on something, wait a bit, come back to it later. And I came back to it during the COVID lockdowns and reread this. And it's always a good sign when you're enjoying reading your own writing.
Yeah.
But I realized very quickly reading this, well, this character is obviously neurodivergent.
Yeah.
And it was not something I had intended at all when I first wrote it. And that was quite fascinating, A, to discover that for the character, and B, just that awareness, 4 years awareness of social, increasing social development of society, and realizing, oh, of course, now I have the words for describing this. Now I can actually explore this a bit more. What does that actually mean for a character to be neurodivergent in Regency era? And that once I had that character, it actually fleshed out a whole lot more of that character path across the book.
Yeah.
Because it meant that it gave a different spin on her interactions for things.
Yeah. And I definitely picked up on that, but I didn't want to say, hey, this character is pretty neurodivergent.
Yeah. But yeah, that awareness of course, there's no, they didn't have the language for it.
No. Yeah.
And I thought it was important that you had this, she's very capable, she's intelligent, she's compassionate, she's not, as I said, those previous, she's not Rain Man,
right?
But she has quirks and she has these traits because it's a spectrum. So you have someone who can function but has developed ways of negotiating and navigating her life through that system. Because of course there would have been, you know, there's interesting discussions as to whether Darcy from Pride and Prejudice is neurodivergent. So yeah, there's a lot of ground there to explore, which really helped me build out the novel.
Yeah, and it's interesting doing it, as a woman in a Regency era, because your whole life is, reading social situations and being the social one, and adhering to conventions and knowing what to say and how to read a room. And I have to get married, and it's like, well, if you can't read any of that, then kind of what position does that put you in?
What has some
Yeah.
interesting pros and cons, because as you said, it's so ingrained in that society, but at the same time, the society has really strict codified rules about all this stuff. So you can actually fall back on those rules, whereas in a modern society, you know, there's no specific code of conduct in anything. So it's all a bit more free form. So I found that interesting as well. There's upsides and downsides to her society and being someone who lives in it.
Yeah. So how did you go about doing that authentically? Was there anything that you had to do to kind of nail that character?
I think for me it was just having an idea of, you know, how someone thinks, what they find important, what they find difficult. I didn't go and do a whole lot of research about neurodivergence, because it's a spectrum. It's, look, could someone like this exist? Is what they're doing believable on a human scale? And once you have that, you know, you don't need a diagnosis. And there's plenty of people out there that are probably on that spectrum somewhere. I mean, we're all, they say, you know, it's perhaps a cliche, but to say everyone's on it somewhere. But everyone is on a scale. Everyone finds those traits there. And I think it's just being true to a character, being honest about, okay, how would someone react to this? What are they good at? What aren't they good at?
Fantastic. Anything else? So this is now you've been through this whole process of publishing your debut novel. Anything that you learned along the way that you're like, oh, this was really great, or you would have maybe done differently next time for your next novel?
I think yeah, there were some great points on the editing. Like the key ones were point of view. In my initial draft, I wavered my point of view quite a lot. So even though you're third person, you're suddenly you're in someone else's head or moving around a bit, and you can move around characters, but you just don't do it all the time. Try and stick to it. It's trying, you know, that was one of the big advices, you know, for this chapter or for this section, whose head are we in? And that really helped pin things down, I think, especially when it is a novel that's mostly in Lucy's head. You do visit other places and other perspectives occasionally. But keeping that on the narrow. And for this one, also the creating the building the veracity of the world. I'd set it in Halstead, which is an English town. I'd done almost no research other than where it is. So what the advice from the editors were was to build on this. Okay, where? Like, they're in Halstead, they're outside of the town. Where are they outside of the town? And from that, you know, actually starting to go into a bit of, okay, what was the history of this town? Okay, it was a market town, so they're going to have market days. Or there actually is a woods here with a name, so I can change the name of this generic woods to this woods or this town or this coastline. And you find out a whole lot about it, but it also builds the geography of your world, builds the truth of this world in a really good way.
Google Earth is a writer's best friend. When you're historical, it's a little more difficult. You have to do a little more digging, but
Yeah, but no, I used it a lot. It was like, okay, I knew that it was a coastal chase scene at the end, but like, okay, well, what point of the coast? And you realize, okay, well, there's a bay there. So if they're at that point of the coast, they've left London, they're going to get there. And you can actually add some really fascinating stuff. I found that the coastline where they are is eroding really, really fast. So they mentioned that, you know, 10 years ago, the church fell into the ocean prior to this novel. And now I think that church was part of a town, and that town is like, you know, like half a mile out to sea now because of that erosion. But it all becomes quite real. And it really, really helps anchor this thing in your mind, your travel times, everything like that is important to have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Fantastic. So yeah. Okay. So now you have your novel. The next step is what most of us dread. Some of us like it, I suppose, as writers, is marketing. And that's getting like increasingly more and more difficult to get visibility, to get yourself out there. How have you found that? What's that been like for you? What have you been doing or asked to do?
My publisher's booked a few interviews like this one, which is really great. bit of social media marketing in New Zealand. I think that will kick up a bit probably once as we get towards the book launch overseas. Again, I'm fortunate to have a publisher with a marketing wing and that side of it, which will make a big difference. I think one of the things that was fascinating for me with the marketing was, again, linking it back to that character, those character traits, because as I said, I've got a theater background, I've got an improv background, give me 15 minutes and I can probably give you a 10 minute talk on any subject. It might not be particularly detailed, but I can, like, I can fake my way through it. But put me in a room full of people and ask me to pitch my novel in conversations, and it's like stroking a cat backwards. And you realize, oh yeah, okay, that's quite a neurodivergent trait, if you want to, you know. Like, and I think everyone has those little gaps and pieces, so it's so in a weird way useful for building out your character. Is part of the marketing stage of things. But yeah, generally, I'll admit I'm sort of, you know, pitching it where I can, but I'm really fortunate to have the excellent publishers who are helping me out on that on that side of things.
Yeah, that definitely helps. Well, fantastic. So after that, the next step is the next book. Is there anything that you're dreaming up working on that you can tell us about or that you would like to do?
I've got various options. I'm sort of, you know, trying to cement a few of them down at the moment. One sort of a spiritual sequel, I guess you'd call it. So in the same vein, more Dickensian, I think, a little bit further in time. So it's not a continuation of these characters. I think most of the, you know, their stories, it's content, you know, you could throw in another story if you wanted to, but it would always feel a bit hollow. Sometimes if you've got what felt like a nice ending. So there's that option. There's another one I'm sort of more action-y, adventure-based one around fairy tales. So it depends on quite where it lands. I'm still sort of, both those ones, I'm still trying to find the character to lock down that character a little bit more. And I think once I have that, generally with my writing, I want to know who my characters are. I need to know my beginning and my end and something that happens in the middle. And then once I've got that, you can just sort of see where it takes you.
Perfect. Well, wonderful. So we'll look forward to that. So just as we are wrapping up, we like to ask everyone, so you're just a little bit farther on this journey than some others. So for those who are maybe a few steps behind, would you have any advice that you would offer newer aspiring writers? What would that be?
Everyone has different writing styles. So find in the styles, find what works for you. If you can read back what you've written and enjoy it, then it might never become a massive success, but it is a success. You know, it's and I think that's the same in every artwork. If you're a painter and you can create a painting that you put on your wall and it never sells, but you really like it, then that's a success. So in terms of that, you know, write something for the joy of creating art that you enjoy, that others around you enjoy, and then take it further. And find niche, find audiences for it, test your work, whether you are writing your fan fiction and you're on a fan fiction website and you get feedback. You know, that now is a really good area to test stuff out. Whether it's, hey, I've written a play and I want to find a local theatre group that can do a staged reading of this play and test those stories. And just keep trying at it. Get something out there to the end as well. You know, if it's not working, sit on it, try something else. Get something to completion, because you can't really start working on fine-tuning something until you've completed it. So even if what you've completed is rubbish, or you realize, oh no, that's awful, and I'm not going to use this. But you know, there was that one character in that short story I wrote who I really liked, and maybe they become a character in something else, or that one line of dialogue that was an awesome line of dialogue, and I'm going to use that in something someday. And you'll find that stuff.
So I'm curious, have you ever or would you ever write a play?
I have, and I would.
I mean, I've done screenplays. I like the idea of writing for theater only because you can see everything play out. You know, like he had mentioned, you can see it play out in real life. You can tweak it for the next show, and you can really perfect it. And some of the best movies that I've seen, you know, like think of A Few Good Men, like that started off as a play. And it's because they're just able to fine tune that dialogue and the action and everything, just to get it so perfect that, you know, I think it's a great proving ground, but I will never do it.
Yeah. I think it would be really interesting to get like the feedback that way, like from actors or set designers or whoever on the spot. Like that's intense feedback. Yeah.
I do think that it is probably a really good exercise in sharpening dialogue.
Yeah.
And figuring out, you know, like you said, like working with actors and kind of seeing like how they read your words and like what they put into it. Because I do think that that is sort of like real-time workshopping in a way. And that's kind of interesting to be able to sort of like play in that sandbox. But I haven't ever done it. But it does sound interesting.
I didn't do very well at it, but I did do it. And I think I would enjoy it if I could kind of spend some time and hone that as a craft. I think I could get behind doing that more often. But, you know, when you're doing plays, there's no point in doing a play unless you can find someone to actually, you know,
put it on.
Produce it.
Yeah.
And unless you want to do it yourself, which is entirely possible. You could turn, you know, there's probably actually tons of community theaters that would welcome somebody who's just churning out plays for them to do, but
yeah,
I think it'd be easier to hone that style in a play than to try to do it writing screenplays. I've written screenplays as well, and you know, spec scripts don't get much love these days, more so in the 90s. I mean, I used to be able to sell stuff in the 90s, but now it's, you know, I can't get anybody's attention anymore.
It's actually kind of interesting. I just read, I told you to get it, a book that sort of incorporates like the whole premise is that it's set in a playhouse, not like the way you would think though, like this magical playhouse. It's a very interesting concept, but the author ended up playing around with, you know, certain scenes were written like a play within the prose. And I just thought that was like a really interesting detail. So I guess, you know, thinking about ways that you could even incorporate writing a play in your own books that aren't necessarily like strict cutouts. It's, mm-hmm. I don't know. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, that's cool. I had that on my TBR. It's number 2. I'm excited to read that.
Yeah, it's really good.
So I thought Ross's journey was really interesting. So like, can I just submit to a New Zealand publisher, just all the big 5 branches in small countries? Is that
why not?
Yes,
I've been kind of going through the reverse of that. So I recently changed my foreign rights agent. I let one go and I hired a new one, and I got emails from 3 of my foreign publishers saying, if you want to work with us directly, you can. Which is very enticing, but like when you take a step back and look at it, like I don't want to deal with the contracts, I don't want to deal with moving the money, I don't want to deal with the tax reporting issues. There's a lot of moving parts there that I, you know, that to me it's 20%, 25% is a lot of money to pay an agent. You know, I think that number should be lower, but it's not something I'm willing to take on myself just to save that money.
Yeah. Mm. Well, what was interesting to me was that he did this with no agent, and then the New Zealand publisher pitched it to the other markets, like the US market.
Right.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, no, that's actually a thing. I mean, because at this point, like what we consider to be the top five publishers, they've all got branches in all the major markets.
Yeah.
So when they, you know, one of them, you know, primarily it happens the other way around. It's typically the US market will then pitch the other, you know, the other branches of that. But they all do talk to each other. So, I mean, you can do this. And you know, a lot of authors that I know that are even with the Amazon imprints, they don't have agents. You don't necessarily need one. And Amazon will get it all over the world, too. Mm-hmm. So I think this is, you know, something to keep an eye on. I think it's something that's changing. And sooner or later, it might get easy enough for authors to do it all on our own, which is probably not something foreign agents want to hear.
Probably not. Yeah. All right. What type of escape room would you design?
Interesting.
I think that would be a really fun creative exercise too.
On a pirate ship, for sure.
I think I'd do something along the lines of what I write in my archaeological thrillers. I have a, you know, this, there's a lot of archaeology based and history based clues floating around in this room, and you have to solve it. Maybe you even put something together, like a lost artifact. It's in pieces.
Well, that's a fun idea. If you're writing, you know, what we were talking about last week, creative marketing ideas. Like,
hey, JD, I just came up with one. You're like my co-authors. Never. You got to do an escape room for your next book. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm so sick of escape rooms. We've got one here in Portsmouth, right down the street from where I live. And they've got five different, you know, experiences in there that you can do. Only one of them is geared towards little kids. And my daughter loves it. So we've been in the same escape room probably 20, 30 times.
You know, did they change every things clue. Up?
No, that's the thing. Oh. It's always like she walks in at this point, like I can sit in the corner of the room and she solves it in like 5 minutes because she knows where every little thing is. But like, she just likes going through those steps. So I am escape roomed out.
No,
and I've never done an escape room on my own or like as an adult, you know, like with friends or anything like that.
Next time we're in Vegas, doing it. And your next book event is going to be an escape room. That's your next book launch. It's going to happen.
At the Horseshoe, there's actually a hidden bar that you have to pass through an escape room, I believe, in order to gain access.
It's not an escape room, but we a bunch of us went in there. It's just a little speakeasy. And it's at the back of that curio cabinet or cabinet.
You took my husband with you. I didn't go.
Did I?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sean went with you.
Yeah.
And then you guys came back. I was like, okay.
The first time we went to that, though, I'm with a bunch of thriller writers and nobody can figure out the clues. And so I ended up solving it and getting us in. But otherwise, we'd still be standing out in the stupid bar.
Geez, thanks for the invite. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think the first time I went, you weren't there.
Oh, this wasn't last year. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe that was a different speakeasy you guys went to last year. I don't know. I just know you and Sean disappeared, and then I was like, okay.
Speakeasies are big around there. I went to a couple of them that were like industry events, like a whole bunch of industry folk were. I think Lulu was putting one on.
I think every casino at this point has at least one speakeasy. It all started with the Mob Museum, because the Mob Museum obviously sort of did that. So, you know, you go up the stairs and you go into the museum, and then they had like a bar and you had to like get the password, and it was sort of like a whole thing. And then now everyone has them. Cosmopolitan has them. Horseshoe has them. Venetian.
All good.
All right. Our resident speakeasy Vegas expert.
We'll find out in November. All right, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Anthony Horowitz coming back. Anthony's one of the UK's most successful authors. He's had multiple New York Times bestsellers across different genres. He also writes for television and stage. His latest novel is called A Deadly Episode. It's the sixth book in his Hawthorne series and releases April 28th. So Anthony Horowitz.
Yeah, sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode, and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.